A1.
Number 9A.
Now, we have been considering in the last lesson the nature and the content of mortal consciousness. This is a very important question because we have seen that we always have to deal with consciousness and never with a material, objective, so-called reality. That everything happens in consciousness, and so we must know what consciousness is. We have started by investigating mortal consciousness, and for the sake of having a bit more order in our presentation, we tried to consider it under various points. We have taken first point one, where we began to ask ourselves what constitutes mortal consciousness. Then in point two, we were seeing that mortal consciousness is always the cause of disharmony, that every disharmony has its origin in mortal consciousness. Then third, we have seen that mortal consciousness is not just an individual mortal consciousness, but that we must see that we can classify mortal consciousness into individual consciousness, universal, collective, and universal consciousness, or individual beliefs, collective beliefs, and universal beliefs. Also, into the two categories of consciousness and unconscious consciousness. Then, as a fourth point, we have seen at the end of the last lesson that mortal consciousness is impersonal, that mortal consciousness, evil, is neither place, thing, nor circumstance, nor person, nor anything like that. And now, today, I want to take the fifth point, which is a rather involved point, where we begin to investigate and see that the belief that is in the majority controls the belief that is in the minority. We must also see that the beliefs that are in the majority are really ruling the beliefs that are in the minority. And in order to present this subject a bit orderly, I would like to make four classifications under it. I will name them A, B, C, D. A. We begin to realize in metaphysics that the universal beliefs always control the collective and the individual beliefs, and that the collective beliefs control the individual beliefs. You see, always that which is in the majority controls that which is in the minority. What does this mean? And we see that this is true as well in a negative sense as well as in a positive sense. In a negative sense, you encounter this concept quite often in the practice and in daily life. So often the individual belief is good, and yet the result is bad, is negative. Why? Say, so often you hear people say, well, I didn't have a single evil thought in my mind, and then this awful thing happened. So often you hear that. Or that a patient would say, I have fallen sick, and I have never thought of sickness. I didn't have a single thought of sickness in my mind, and yet I did fall sick. Or that they would say, I never believed in a curse. in the Roman Catholic curse, in the Jesuitic curse, in the curse of the East, or in black magic, and etc., etc. I never believed in a curse, and yet I see that I'm under the curse. Or somebody would say, I didn't know at all that there is an epidemic in town. I not even heard of it, and yet I have fallen sick. I have come under this epidemic. Or somebody would say, I have got this and this disease, and will name the disease and say, I have never heard of such a disease. I never knew that such a disease existed. Therefore, how could I get that sickness if I never knew that such a thing existed? Or you have the harmless little child eating, say, a poisonous berry. That child doesn't know that the berry is poisonous. On the contrary, it thinks it will be very good for me, it will be wonderful, and eats it and gets poisoned. So you see, these are questions which come up over and over, which would defy, so to say, what we have seen up to now, namely that our subjective state of consciousness determines the effect. See, up to now we have seen that our subjective consciousness, that what we have in our mentality, determines the effect on our body, on our life. Now all these arguments which I have just given before would negate such a so-called law. Now, what is the answer? And the answer is that the majority of belief rule the minority of belief. That because there is a majority of belief which says there is an epidemic in town, because there is a universal belief that such and such a berry is poisonous, and so on, that majority of belief really rules the individual belief. Let me state that in Mrs. Eddy's own language. She says, if a dose of poison is swallowed through mistake and the patient dies, even though physician and patient are expecting favorable results, does human belief, you ask, cause death? Can you see the question? Physician and patient expect an improvement, but by mistake they have taken a poisonous pill and the patient dies. So Mrs. Eddy asks, therefore, does then human belief cause death? They didn't believe that they would die, and yet they died. And so she answers, even so, and as directly as if the poison had been intentionally taken. In such a case, a few persons believe that the potion swallowed by the patient to be harmless. Only a few patients think it is harmless, or even think that will do me good. But the vast majority of mankind, though they know nothing of this particular case and this special person, believe the arsenic to be poisonous. Consequently, she says, the result is controlled by the majority of opinion, not by the infinitesimal minority of opinions in the sixth chamber. So here you have in the Christian Science textbook a very clear explication that we have to be aware that the majority of beliefs control the minority of beliefs, and that therefore it is not enough to be individually right, but that we must see that we find the right idea about everything. I will come back to that later on. For the moment, we just see that in metaphysics the same law exists as in jurisprudence, namely that ignorance really does not protect us from evil. That ignorance does not protect us from evil. That in our ignorance we can believe the nicest things and the best thing to come to happen, but the majority may think otherwise, and the majority rules. So you see how here an individual belief in good may be overruled by a majority of the belief in evil. You also have the contrary belief, namely that a belief can be positive. For instance, we have that with drugs. Mrs. Eddy says, when the sick recover by the use of drugs, it is the law of the general belief culminating in individual faith which heals. You see, you may have an individual faith in a drug, but that may not be strong enough to heal you. But a whole majority, a general belief, may believe that this and this drug is good, and therefore acts in a way that heals and relieves the patient. So again, when we deal with drugs, we can see that it is the general belief in the drug, not only in the individual belief in the drug, which heals. And that we have to see so often, because so often you hear people say, who are in hospital or have medical treatment and have to take pills and so on, that they say, oh, but I don't believe in drugs, so they can't do anything to me. Or they would even say, oh, I didn't know that they have given me a drug. They put it into my coffee or tea or in my meals and so on. I not even knew that they were giving me a drug. And yet, it did help. So again, they would say, this law that our subjective mentality is the cause of recovering effect is not true, because they say, I didn't know. So here again, we must see that it is the majority of belief which rules. Mrs. Eddy says that like this. She says, even when you take away the individual confidence in the drug, see, even if we have no individual belief in the effectiveness of the drug, you have not yet divorced the drug from the general faith. The general faith just still gives, really, to that drug its so-called power. She says, the chemist, the botanist, the druggist, the doctor, and the nurse equip medicine with their faith. And the belief, which are in the majority, rule. Now, I come to the second classification B, where we begin to see that in mortal consciousness, the stronger belief controls the weaker. Say that the stronger individual belief controls the weaker individual belief. And on this so-called law rests a lot of hypnotism, of willpower, and so on. Mrs. Eddy says, in this regard, she says, a patient's belief is more or less molded and formed by his doctor's belief in the case. See, a patient may be sick. The patient may have a certain belief about the sickness, how long it will take, how it will develop, and so on. But the doctor, who is again an individual, has his own belief about it. Now, which belief will rule? The patient's belief or the doctor's belief? Which one is stronger? They are both individual beliefs. So, Mrs. Eddy says, I repeat it again, a patient's belief is more or less molded and formed by the doctor's belief in the case, even though the doctor says nothing to support his theory. His thoughts and his patient's commingle, and the stronger thoughts rule the weaker. And you know exactly that that is so. The moment the doctor looks very, very severe and very troubled when he examines the patient, then the patient yields to that look and thinks, oh, I think the doctor doesn't think that's going all right. He's afraid. He sees dark. And so the patient's hope perhaps just wanes away and is exchanged against the fear which the doctor has himself. So you can see that the stronger belief is ruling the weaker one. That's why we have so often that one individual can control the other. If an individual has a strong mentality, a strong force, a strong will, and another person a weak will, then the stronger will just rule that other person, can do with that other person just what it wants to do. This is the basis of hypnotism, that you can only hypnotize somebody who has a weaker mentality. You will never be able to hypnotize, say, a man who has a strong understanding of what God is. You just can't hypnotize him. Or you have the same so-called law in all those methods of auto-suggestion, of self-suggestion, where within one's own individuality you try to strengthen your belief that things go better and better every day, things go better and better every day, things go better and better every day, and you just assure yourself that it goes better, so that the individual belief that things will go worse will submit to the stronger self-will. So auto-suggestion really builds on this so-called law that the stronger belief in oneself will rule the weaker belief in oneself, and therefore tries to strengthen the good belief in oneself against the negative concepts we may entertain in ourselves. See, that's also an explication why the sinners are usually very healthy, that the the sinners flourish like a green bay tree, yes. Why? It's very easy to see that. And you see in life very often that the sinners are really in much better health than the others. Why? Because in their inward mentality, they are so convinced that what they do is all right and will not be punished. Will not be punished. They don't think that they will be punished for what they do. So they have no bad conscience. There is not always a struggle going on within themselves between good and evil. They just enjoy thoroughly what they do, and there is no struggle within them. And so the stronger will rules. They usually have no sense of guilt. They have a self-assurance. They have no inner conflicts. And so you see that their firm conviction that what they do will have no evil effect, that will not be penalized, keeps them out of an inward struggle, of inward conflicts. And therefore, they go on usually for quite a while very healthy and very successfully. Now, you would think, well, then what chance has the individual against the majority? What can then the individual do if he is ruled by the majority? If he is ruled by what the universal belief hold about us, what the collective beliefs put up in regard to us? Has the individual therefore any chance to free himself from this collective and universal mortal consciousness? And there we must see that only if we find a power which is greater than a collective and a universal belief, that only if we find such a power that the individual can free himself from these beliefs. And that is the reason why we have to understand God, because God, the all-in-all, is much bigger than humanity's universal and collective and individual's belief. God, the all-in-all, as the only creator and the only power, really alone can rule these beliefs. And so the individual can only protect himself against this mortal consciousness by being one with something which is bigger than it, namely with God. And now we come back, you see, to see why we must have an understanding of God. Because only a consciousness which is one with God rules universal belief, rules over the collective beliefs, and rule over individual beliefs. Let me quote from Mrs. Eddy. She says the following thing in the textbook. The universal belief in physics, and my word, that in this century the universal belief in physics really is terrifically great. There was never an age, a century, in which the belief in physics was bigger than today. She says, the universal belief in physics weighs against the high and mighty truths of Christian metaphysics. This erroneous general belief, which sustains medicine and produces all medical results, works against Christian science. And now comes the answer. And the percentage of power on the side of this science must mightily outweigh the power of popular belief in order to heal a single case of disease. See, she says, we have only a chance to heal somebody, to heal a single case of disease, if our understanding of what science is, what God is, mightily outweighs the beliefs in disease, the general beliefs, the universal beliefs. So indicating that an understanding of science is really the only power that can deal with the universal beliefs in matter, the universal beliefs in catastrophes, the universal beliefs in storms and floods, the universal belief in disease and death and so on. Or she would say, when the general belief endorses the inanimate drug as doing this or that, individual dissent or faith, unless it rests on science, is but a belief held by a minority, and such a belief is governed by the majority. See, that if the universal belief endorses a drug of doing this or that, being poisonous or helpful, the individual belief has no chance not to be governed by this belief, unless, as Mrs. Eddy says, this individual consciousness rests on science. And we begin to feel, you see, how important it is, therefore, that our consciousness is at one with God, and understandingly, scientifically one with God. Or else we just have no chance whatever in this world to free ourselves from all the myriad beliefs that humanity holds. Now I go on to a third point, C. We had A, B, C under this point 5. We come to now A, B, we had, now we come to C, which are still under point 5. Here I want to discuss the question of faith healing. Of faith healing. You know that the question of faith healing has since centuries and centuries interested mankind. All religions and all kinds of sects are interested in faith healing. In all various forms of faith healing. And the interest, I think, is even more awake in this age than ever before. Many of the churches now devote more interest to the question of healing through their religious faith. Healing on a spiritual basis is not something that is unique to Christian Science, not by a long sight. Dozens and dozens of Christian and other religions give their deepest interest to this angle of religion, namely to heal. And so we have to be clear about the nature of such faith healing. What is really faith healing? And we can understand it when we consider what we have said before. We will find that the stronger belief rules the lesser. Well, our faith in God may be stronger than our belief in disease. And the moment our belief, and I say belief, I don't say understanding, the moment our belief in God is stronger than our belief in disease, well, then we have a certain chance that the belief in God, who we believe will help us, will be the stronger mortal consciousness than our belief in disease. It may be that within us the faith in wonders and in the possibility of miracles and wonders may be much stronger than our human reasoning. And if our belief in mysticism, in magic, our belief in wonders and miracles is stronger than human reasoning, then there is a fair chance that this belief in magic will rule human reasoning. That's why people who may not have a strong intellect are in a position to experience faith healing much more than people who all their life have only rested on reasoning and on human understanding. Therefore, the more simple people, as we may call them, may benefit more from faith healing than others. But what is really happening? What is really happening is that it is only another form of a stronger belief ruling a weaker belief. That's all there is about it. It has nothing at all to do with God, though it is called a belief in God or faith in God. This faith healing is very old. At the time of Moses, it was practiced very often. We read this in the book of Moses. It's in, must be in numerology, in numbers. There we find such faith healing. Mrs. Eddy says about those incidents, she says, the Israelites looked upon the brazen serpent and straightway believed that they were healed of the poisonous stings of vipers. Whenever the Israelites on their wandering through the deserts were bitten by a viper, they just looked up to an idol, to a brazen serpent, and they believed that the viper therefore could not kill them and were healed by it. You see, it is a belief in a idol that can heal. Jesus would say so often to somebody who got healed, he said, thy faith has healed thee. He didn't say God Almighty has healed thee. Thy faith has healed thee. They had many of them had a faith that Jesus would have a supernatural power to heal them. And so all what was for them necessary were their faith in Jesus. Or We read in the Christian Science textbook the following thing, which you must really understand properly. It's in the chapter on prayer, where she says, quoting from the Bible, she says, "The prayer of faith shall save the sick, says the Scriptures." What is this healing prayer? Then she says, a mere request that God will heal the sick has no power to gain more of the divine presence than is already attained. Then she gives the following explication. The beneficial effect of such prayer for the sick is on the human mind, making it act more powerfully on the body through a blind faith in God. See, this, however, is one belief casting out another, a belief in the unknown, casting out a belief in sickness. See, in faith healing, under this prayer of faith, the belief in the unknown is so strong, is so mystical, is so magic, that it is much bigger than the belief in sickness. So, such a prayer which calls on God has really nothing to do at all with God's all presence, with God's power. It has only to do with the individual belief in an unknown God, which is stronger than the belief in sickness. She says further down that page, she says, prayer to a corporeal God. Well, and until we understand God in its signs, we always pray to a corporeal God. Prayer to a corporeal God affects the sick like a drug. You see, she makes an equation, so to say, and says that faith in a corporeal God is the very same thing as faith in a drug. There is nothing, no difference between them. So prayer to a corporeal God affects the sick like a drug, which has no efficacy of its own, but borrows its power from human faith and belief. So neither the concept of a corporeal God nor the drug by itself has any saving effect. The saving effect which we may experience is our belief in either the drug or in an unknown God, which can bring about such an effect. So we mustn't be surprised, you see, that faith healing sometimes or very often show quite fantastic results. That the stronger the belief is, the more awake, the more vital a belief and a faith in God is, naturally, the more it is possible that the stronger belief rules the lesser belief.